Welcome to Michigan Writers on the Air, a program about writers, writing, reading, and listening here in northern Michigan. I'm Aaron Stander. In the opening interview, Benjamin Bush will provide some background on his feature article in the October Harper's, Today is Better Than Tomorrow, A Marine Returns to a Divided Iraq. Then Lynn Ray Perkins will tell us about her delightful new book, Nuts to You. At the end, Fleeta Brown will be here with an audio essay on writer Raymond Carver. I am here with the multi-talented Benjamin Bush. Welcome, Benjamin.
Thank you for having me.
Benjamin is a writer, actor, film director, and former Marine Corps infantry officer who served two combat tours in Iraq. His television roles have included appearances on The Wire, Homicide, West Wing, and Generation Kill. In recent years, Benjamin wrote, produced, and directed a prize-winning film, Bright, and a full-length memoir, Dust to Dust. Today, we are going to be talking about his article in this month, October's Harper's Magazine, Today is Better Than Tomorrow, A Marine Returns to a Divided Iraq. So this comes from a trip that you made to Iraq in December of 2013.
It is. I went there at the same time I was having a birthday, so I figured it was a good conclusion of two events.
And you were going back to a region that you had served in during the Iraq War.
I was the provisional military mayor of a number of very small satellite towns near the Iranian border in 2003, and I kind of arrived there into a vacuum, which was that the Saddam's government obviously had fled and left most of these small areas leaderless as well as empty of any security forces. So we didn't go in there to fight so much as to reestablish authority of any kind. And that was a matter of innovation because there was no post-hostilities plan, nor was there any kind of template for how to establish security or how to foster democracy or restore critical infrastructure. All these things were the biggest concerns we had. So each unit solved its own problems or made their own problems. What I didn't want to be guilty of at that first moment, at our first intersection as people, was to be guilty of incomprehension. I didn't want to go with ideas to impose. I wanted to go and study the ideas that were there. And so that's how I arrived into a very small town called Jisan. And that was what I returned to Iraq to go find. I hadn't heard anything from that town in 10 years.
And this time, your first time there, it was before the insurgency.
It was.
And there was sort of a hope of democracy?
There was. I mean, it was a clean slate. We had no idea what was going to happen next, and neither did they. So we kind of had this interesting opportunity to see what would be natively born. And unfortunately, they weren't so sure what that would be. The last time we'd encouraged a democratic form was in 1991. And the people who had taken that charge, who had risen up against Saddam in 91, were abandoned. We hung them out to dry. We left, leaving Saddam in power. And the members of those revolutionary groups were identified and executed. That in 91. And that was something also interesting because in 2003, very near Jisan, was a very large mass grave of people who had been brought from Kut and killed because of that uprising. So that was our legacy coming in. Mm-hmm. They'd never actually seen Americans mm-hmm. get that far. And then that they'd never seen us stay and really enforce these ideas we claimed to encourage.
Now, you flew in, and I reference an earlier article in Harper's Magazine in 2009. That article, you talked about being a Marine, a combatant in Iraq. The tone of that article and this article are very different, and your coming into Baghdad this time was very different. Instead of a military aircraft, you arrived how?
I came in by commercial air. I flew out of Amman, Jordan, and jumped into Baghdad airport. And there was no one to greet me. There was nothing, before with the military, You don't worry about visas. You invite yourself, and everything is laid out for you. My visa was that I was armed, and this time I went stripped. I had nothing but an interpreter, and my plan was frail enough to simply be arrive in Baghdad, meet my interpreter, get a cab, and head east.
And there's an interesting note early in that article where you talk about the large international hotel with the flags of all important nations, but one flag is missing.
Our flag. Yeah, this is one of the hotels where almost all the journalists from 2003 all the way till 2011 mm-hmm. had primarily stayed, the original Sheraton and the one across the street from it. And they had this large arc of international flags without the American flag. And that was one of the things which I discovered immediately, was that our presence was invisible. We were entirely gone from Iraq.
And that's so interesting, given the history. We gave a lot of blood there, 3,000 plus killed, 50,000 injured, $2 to $3 trillion spent, and a few years later, we're just invisible.
I was most surprised simply because I thought that we had invested a number of business ventures in the country. That was more and more transparently our behavior in Iraq, was that we were encroaching into the oil industries and the reconstruction industries, which is where a lot of our tax money went. And not only were most of those projects never finished and were not operating, those contracts were now being run by Iranians, Turks, the Russians were drilling the oil. Everyone from the outside except us really had moved in and filled that space, which was well-funded. Iraq is not poor. Iraq is making an awful lot of money now from its oil, which it is selling mostly to the Chinese. And America doesn't seem to be participating very much in that, despite the old call that oil would pay for the war and various other things. All those relationships, I mean, contractors were there for 9 years, heavily and expensively. And they were also gone. I found that entirely surprising. The thing that I did see, and actually the only real evidence of America I saw, were that the Iraqis were wearing our uniforms, holding our weapons, and driving our vehicles.
In the article, you referenced that this is such a historical piece of geography. It goes back at least 10,000 years. It is the cradle of civilization, or Western civilization, part of the Fertile Crescent. And over that time, every major army or empire controlled this for a bit.
For a bit. Yeah. And there are ruins that kind of show the earlier empires, not so much the later empires. There is some infrastructure built by the British. The barrage dams that control the water flow in the Tigris and Euphrates are still British. But what was amazing to see was that the one place that commemorated the last of the empires, the British Empire from World War I, was a small cemetery of 420 soldiers in Kut. Most of them themselves also foreigners to the British, being Indian troops brought in from their colonies in India. And this one small space was cleaned, we could say discovered by Marines in Task Force Tarawa in 2003. It wasn't discovered. I mean, it was known to have been there by the Graves Commission. But it was a dump. It was used just to throw trash. And mostly out of convenience, not out of disrespect specifically. And the Marines cleaned it and rededicated it. The British returned for that celebration. And there it was, a number of British and Indian soldiers that had been laid to rest up until about 1920 in the Kut War Cemetery. And upon my arrival there to see it again, in 2013, I found it overgrown and destroyed, returned to being a dump. And what was worse was that the stones were not just toppled, but they'd been utilized as just material. They were filling potholes in the streets. They were used as steps to houses. And that was something which really just completely surprised me. I hadn't anticipated seeing, you know, something which people so clearly know, and there's a great deal of weight to putting a name and a date to marking someone's resting place. And to consider that meaningless surprised me. For people who carry their dead all the way to Najaf and Karbala, you know, the two largest cemeteries in the world are in Iraq, and they would disrespect this one so much. I just saw all of history collapsing in one small square of city.
It was just one more invading army, just the remnants.
Just the last of us, yeah. And of course, there are no Americans buried in Iraq. We left not even that. We took our 4,486 dead and our wounded and came back here. So I found it to be this interesting intersection of comprehension of history. And I remember talking to an interpreter who had been an interpreter for an American unit in Baghdad. And I asked him, you know, what do you feel is most important about your history? And he came with a great question. He said, is history even true? And I thought, wow, that's profound. Because is it?
Yeah.
It's all the choices we make. Does anyone really belong anywhere? And does anywhere really belong to anyone? And I think as you see Iraq now falling apart and being redefined, the whole region being redefined, Syria falling apart, Egypt having its problems, the Kurdistan and Turkey, and eventually Saudi Arabia and everyone else, these borders which have been created in order for the simplicity of nation states is now being questioned again. And history is going to be the one thing that people try to pull back to create the new myth, you know?
Which is hard to do in Iraq because...
Yeah, and I talk about that in the article a bit, is that, you know, it's almost impossible to even get a sense of nationhood in this great expanse. You have these islands of towns. They're just kind of populating this sea of dust. And what I found interesting, and, you know, this is a point that I make in the Harper's piece, is that these islands on their own survived more than the nation did because of their isolation, because of the fact that they always knew themselves as Jassani. The people there told me, you know, before Saddam, before any of this, before the Americans, we didn't consider ourselves Iraqi. We considered ourselves Jassani first. We're from the town of Jassan. And when I first saw the town again, there was all this new construction. And I thought that people were moving to this place. You know, why would anyone come to the edge of nowhere to build a new home, a big concrete and brick house? And in talking to a policeman there, it turns out that no one had moved there. They were moving off of the old ancient mound town that, you know, that had borne all these families, all these tribes. And Jassan had survived all of it, although it was still in a state of transformation into a modern town from an ancient one. It was immune to the outside because there was no mobility between these villages and the cities. The cities were impossible to create an isolated idea or population within. There's just trade made it impossible. But in these small villages, they could still do that. And that's what I found really interesting about Jassan, was that although 10 years later, you know, 9 of the original 11 councilmen that I met with every day except the holy day for 4 months in that small place in 2003 were still on the council. The place was in this weird strait of inertia while it was still progressing within the new nation. That was interesting.
So during your stay there, you were charged with essentially repairing infrastructure and schools, hospitals, that kind of thing?
We were told to focus on things, you know, the hearts and minds is always the simple phrase. And that went down to restore critical infrastructure like clinics, focus on schools because children were the future. Those are typical phrases that we go with. And it was easy to do because they were in a state of disrepair. And with very little, you could do an awful lot in terms of bringing something up to better code. But in truth, in asking about those projects in 2013, the villagers were quick to say, well, that was just kind of cosmetic. It didn't mean anything. It didn't progress us anywhere. It didn't move society forward. The Americans came and kind of painted things, mm-hmm. and then they left. And that was their memory of us. It wasn't something that they had any animosity about, which I was happy to kind of get a sense for. But there was a disappointment that we hadn't invested. Mm-hmm. We hadn't really spent time they just thought we had everything. But all I brought were, you know, ammunition. You know, that's what I had.
Yeah.
Everything else was just idea and effort. And I had to try to make their ideas work without giving them the ideas to work on. And I think that was a big problem that Americans had, was trying to come there and recreate our democracy in a place that was unprepared to accept that kind of thinking. We were very imposing in a lot of our politics. We imposed entire governmental systems on them.
Yes.
And eventually we imposed their leadership. We chose their leaders. We chose Maliki, mm-hmm. who really is the father of Iraq's destruction by disregarding both the Kurds and specifically disenfranchising the Sunnis. And because of that, they welcomed ISIL in, you know, at first just as a thorn in Maliki's side, but now they're living with them.
I'm talking to Benjamin Bush. This is Michigan Writers on the Air. So your article doesn't talk about it directly. The collapse of Iraq tied very much to what? No central nation, no thought of...
No singular identity.
No singular identity.
Yeah, and I think with our what we introduced as democracy, we kind of introduced it forcefully and sloppily. The idea that everyone had a vote was obviously a great urge, mm-hmm. and equity. But what we kind of didn't seem to see coming was that these divisions of both ethnicity with, you know, respect to the Kurds, but the Sunni and Shia division by religion, they coexisted without too much violence for a long time, not just because of the repression of the Saddam's regime, but because they really didn't have a whole lot of hatred for each other.
Yeah, yeah.
And in many, many mixed neighborhoods. Baghdad was a mixed neighborhood. There were Sunnis spread throughout the entire country, and Shia had moved also. And what democracy taught them was to pick sides. I think it created the divisions that we see now, which are maybe irreversibly violent. And what the Sunnis learned is that if identity is political power and you identify as Sunni, there's only 20% of you forever. Mm-hmm. If you look at the democratic system we have in place now with respect to our own government, if the Democrats or Republicans say that they only have 49% of the representatives, they can't get anything done, which sounds insane to me. They can't get 2% of anyone to agree with them. That's what we've had for years here. This is our shining example to the world of how democracy should work, and we've had one of the least effective governments in a long time.
Yeah.
Well, the Sunnis were looking at that too. And their thought was, if we only have 20% of the population forever, we'll never get anything we want, ever, unless we kill voters, unless we change populations, mm-hmm. unless we either divide or we once again conquer. That was the options left to them, because as soon as Maliki, with the Shia majority and Shia militias, got in power, he began to take them out of positions of authority. And traditionally, they always had the Ministry of Defense because they were the nationalists. Mm-hmm. And the Shia had the Ministry of Interior, which is the police. Right now, it's almost parity. You almost can't tell the difference, and the numbers are almost the same. And there's hope that the new coalition government will bring the Sunnis back in and encourage Anbar to rise again like they did in the Anbar Awakening of 2007-2008 against these very same people. And when I was in Ramadi in 2005, which I don't address in the article but is relevant to this discussion, we were fighting Syrians most of the time, very committed jihadists. Mm-hmm. And we didn't realize that this was a bigger idea. We just thought it was against us because they came to fight us. They weren't really fighting anybody else in the region. But this was the beginning of the Islamic State all the way back in 2005. We just didn't see the larger picture. And maybe they didn't at the time either. But it seems awful suspicious now.
Yeah. The title of the article suggests a defeat. Today is better than tomorrow. I mean, that's so pessimistic.
The way I describe it, the way I describe my interpreter even saying it, is that he's kind of he's just a survivor. He's got survivor's fatigue. Mm-hmm. If you're alive in Baghdad, it's been through an uncertain life. They live in uncertainty. They keep their children at home. There's always the possibility that a car will just explode on their street. That's how they've lived for, 11 years now. And it doesn't seem to be improving. In fact, it's worsening now with the Islamic State on its way and the Iraqi army itself capitulating at every chance they get. So the idea that you, as a child, in 2003, the feeling was that anything was possible now. You could be a child and grow up to be a teacher, an engineer. You could be a political leader. There are all those little things we say in America, like, hey, you can grow up to be the president if you really want to. Mm-hmm. It's not entirely true. But there's that idea that now, girls can go to school and move into better positions in society. And there'll be more opportunities. Now they don't feel that. They children in school, you ask them, what do you dream of doing? What do you want to do? And they kind of have this strange hesitation. Like, what can I possibly do? I mean, I could maybe join the military or I could join the police. But I don't know that I'm going to make it that far. Either one of them is a fatal job now. And those are the best jobs in Iraq. The best paying job is either to be a corrupt official or mm-hmm. to be in the military where you get $1,000 a month, which is a stunning increase. Because in 2003, as I mentioned in the essay, is that there's this weird economic transformation within Iraq where everyone was paid under Saddam. It was kind of pacified the nation by way of the purse. He took a note from, the Soviets. And even if you didn't do anything or do it well, you made just enough to get by. And that keeps everyone in line along with other things, other fear-based factors. When we arrived, suddenly no one was being paid for anything. And they went from an expectation, a society of expectation, to one of uncertainty. And it never righted itself. Mm-hmm. Very few positions really did pay. We established very little political and economic stability in the 9 years that we ran shop. And then that became punitive. Once Maliki was able to control the purse himself, he was able to exclude entire sectors of the state, specifically the Sunnis, who then couldn't get jobs in the military because he couldn't trust them. And the police certainly couldn't trust them. That's where they are right now. And you wonder how anyone can dream of something they could grow up to be. When I saw that, the children in Baghdad, they live in movies and video games because they can't really leave their apartments. Their parents are too afraid to let them out.
Yeah.
They can't gather in areas because they'll be targeted. What is the future to those families and to those children? I found that to be haunting.
Absolutely. I'm talking with Benjamin Bush. We're talking about his article in the October Harper's Magazine. So, Benjamin Bush, what's next for you?
Well, I'm working on a screenplay right now, which has nothing to do with Iraq. And I write a lot of poetry because...
Successfully.
Well, we'll see about that. I don't know quite what that means for poetry, but each poem is a success or failure with each reader. I've mm-hmm. always kind of felt the balancing of those words and giving so few to say such large things. So I work on those things, and I plant trees and build stone walls and, you know.
Do all the things writers, actors, and
Robert
artists
Frost
do.
Would do.
Yes. Well, it's a great article. It's still on the newsstands, and I hope you will pick it up and look at it. Benjamin Bush, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Aaron.
You're listening to Michigan Writers on the Air on IPR News Radio. I'm delighted to welcome Lynn Ray Perkins back to Michigan Writers on the Air. Lynn Ray is a very prolific author and illustrator of books for children and young adults, including 6 picture books and 4 novels. In 2006, Lynn Ray received the John Newbery Medal for the most distinguished contribution to American literature for children for her young adult novel, Crisscross. Today, Lynn Ray is here to talk about squirrels and acorns and her newest book, Nuts to You. Well, nuts to you.
Nuts to us all, Aaron.
And welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Nuts to You is a novel with lots of wonderful illustrations. You illustrate your own books, which is sort of unusual, but everything works together so beautifully. Could you talk about that?
Well, I started out as an artist, not a writer, and I didn't actually start writing until I was 35 years old or so. And so sometimes I'm much more comfortable telling a story with pictures. And I tend to go back and forth between writing and drawing. Sometimes when I am writing, an idea for a picture will suggest itself and I'll jot it down. And then sometimes when I'm working on the picture, something I've been struggling with in the writing will sort itself out. So they're both fun things to do. And I hesitate to give up either one of them in favor of the other. So I just keep doing them both.
So as the story moves along, chapter by chapter, do you have the illustrations and the text done before you move forward, or?
No.
Okay.
Actually, in this book, I wrote the whole first draft without any illustrations. And then thinking I was all done with the manuscript, I started illustrating, and only to find out from my editor that I was not all done with the manuscript, which went through several rewrites. So then I was in the back and forth mode because I would be really getting into the drawing, and Virginia would send me some notes. Well, what about this and what about that? And I think this needs to tighten up a little bit. And
so this is a fairly large book. What, a couple hundred pages?
It has all those pages, but yep. They're small pages with a lot of space. So it's it's not really that
the kind
long
of
books of a book.
I like.
Yeah.
How long did the rewrites take? People are always interested in that process and the amount of time that an author spends on bringing a manuscript to a level that an editor is happy with.
Right. And it's a little hard to say because I'm going back and forth, and the whole thing took me about a year and a half, mm-hmm. At least several months. Let's see, a year and a half is how many months? Like 18 months. So I'm sure I spent at least 9 months on the drawings because it took me a while to figure out how I wanted to draw the squirrels and to get really in that mode. And probably maybe 9 months for the story. I'm just guessing.
What age group is this intended for?
Well, for...
And I ask the question because parents and grandparents and Christmas is coming. And
right, exactly. Well, for kids who are going to read it themselves, the suggested age is 8 to 11 or 12. It's a great read aloud for kids who are younger than that. And I think that the adults who do the reading aloud will enjoy it as well. I think the group, according to Pamela Grath, who sells books up in Northport, the group that's going to be left out is teenagers who think they're too cool to read a kid's book.
Mm-hmm. But as an adult who's read it, it's just great fun. It's just a great story.
Thank you.
The squirrels. I know you live in Michigan, northern Michigan, in a small town that is filled with oak trees and squirrels.
Well, you know,
setting sort of close to home, I think.
Yeah, yeah. A thought came to me the other day, and I wrote it down, and I was thinking of posting it on Facebook, but I didn't want to hurt anybody's feelings. And the thought was, people think I'm much more interested in squirrels than I actually am. I keep getting all these squirrel gifts. And the truth is that the story started because I was working on another book, and the phrase popped into my head, the squirrel who cried wolf.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought it was really funny. So I wrote a little story about it, which turned out to be the first chapter. And then I continued on. But, you know, any of the, as you put it, you know, the great rodent adventure novel genre, they're not really about squirrels or mice. They're about people. And the rodents are just standing in for us. And they let us, I think they let us laugh at ourselves, and they let us see ourselves without getting our feelings hurt.
So did you research squirrel behavior?
Well, I did. I mean, somewhat. There's a lot of behavior in this book that is not true squirrel behavior.
They have been anthropomorphized a bit.
Yeah, they have. They have. They're fairly philosophical squirrels. But I did do research about... I wanted certain things to be accurate.
You know, yesterday, as I was thinking about this interview, I Googled squirrels and research and was amazed to discover that there's an enormous amount of research going on about squirrels on university campuses, because squirrels are very handy.
In what way?
They're on university campuses everywhere.
Oh, I see. They're handy for research.
Yes,
they're available.
Undergraduates are getting harder to grab hold of in research, but the squirrels are there.
And they haven't learned to resist.
they
can't say no to a
exactly.
Treat.
The initiating event of this story is... and we talk about the rodent road trip adventure novel involves one of the squirrels and a hawk.
Right, right. Well, the joke of the first chapter is that there's a squirrel who's crying wolf, as in the classic crying wolf story, to get attention. And one of his fellow squirrels ignores him, but then it's a hawk who swoops down and snatches Jed away. And the squirrel who was crying wolf realizes that he should have cried hawk, hawk. So.
and that takes place in the second chapter. Maybe that would be a...
That's the first chapter.
Oh, so, first chapter. Oh, no. The actual flying.
Right, right. The part where Jed miraculously, well...
Yes. Would you like to read that for us?
I will. I would love to read it. This is chapter 2, and it's called Up in the Air.
And I should say that this is Lynn Ray Perkins reading from...
Nuts to You. There was Jed, dangling inside a hawk's clenched talons high above the earth. And yet, when the little voice inside him told Jed to give up, to let go of his life, another little voice said, "Nope, I don't think so." He opened his eyes. He had to tilt his face downward to do it. The world whizzing by was so far below. Jed was used to heights, being a squirrel and a leaper, but he didn't usually look down much. He had never looked down from this far up, and he felt queasy. Were those treetops or small bushes? He was tempted again to give up. The situation did seem hopeless. Could it be any more hopeless? Actually, amazingly, yes. He realized that it could. He could have been pierced by talons or torn asunder. But Jed couldn't help noticing that while he was in a death grip and terrified, he seemed to be intact, in one piece, unpierced. This went against everything he had been taught about hawk snatchings. so he did a quick inspection of himself to be sure. It was easy to tell that his heart was still beating. It was drumming as loud and as fast as a grouse in springtime. He wiggled his fingers and toes. All there. He flicked his tail and it moved. He couldn't see it, but he could feel it. So there is hope, he said to himself. But don't be dazzled. You are definitely in a fix. Pay attention. Use your knowledge of the enemy. A note. Enemy is such a strong word, it might be more sporting to say adversary or the other team. Sometimes the thing to do is to invite your adversary for cake and lemonade and see if they can become your friend. It can save a whole lot of grief later on. But when you are Team Squirrel and the other team is Team Hawk, this is not a good idea. Because as far as the hawk is concerned, you are the cake, and also the lemonade. When a hawk says, I love squirrels, it says it in the way humans might say, I love potato chips. What do I know about our friend the hawk? Jed mused. A note. If someone, your teacher maybe, ever asks what irony or being ironic means, you can say it when a squirrel says, our friend the hawk, and you will be right. What do I know about our friend the hawk? Jed mused as he was carried through the air at fur-flattening speed. I mean, what do I really know? Because squirrels have a lot of ideas about hawks that are not accurate. Like, all hawks are strong and powerful but not very bright, which is something we like to think about creatures who are stronger than we are. Or, hawks are slobs, or hawks can't smell. That one is true. They don't have a good sense of smell. Speaking of which, Jed observed that the hawk was itself smelly, but he did not see how that information could be useful. They do have sharp eyesight, of course. Everyone knows that. Hawkeye, eyes like a hawk. But what else? Jed felt that there was something in the back of his brain, on the tip of his tongue. He was usually a cool customer, but he was flustered by his predicament. Think, 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 he said to himself. All he could think of was mice. Hawks like to eat mice. That was one thing he knew for sure. An idea formed in his mind. It was a lame idea, but it was the only one he had. Mice, he squeaked. What? Said the hawk. What did you say? Nothing, Jed squeaked, making his voice sound frightened this time, which wasn't hard. Then, in what he hoped was a different voice, he called out, The field is full of mice today. He did not know if there were mice in the field or not, but most fields have mice. Mice are everywhere. Anyway, that wasn't the point. It was a tactic, a trick. For an instant, the hawk, scanning for mice, eased his grip ever so slightly. And in that instant, Jed relaxed his muscles. It was a technique from the ancient squirrel defensive martial art of high tree, not well known because it doesn't work most of the time, because it is so hard to do when your situation is not relaxing. But Jed concentrated and completely relaxed his muscles. Like the great Houdini escaping a straitjacket, and he slipped like water through the distracted hawk's talons. Thick water, or perhaps like a non-Newtonian fluid. Look it up on YouTube. The hawk, truth be told, was mostly distracted, not because Jed was shouting about mice, but by the fact that Jed was still alive. Food was supposed to be limp at this point. This food was not limp, and when it started speaking, it gave him the heebie-jeebies. He lost his focus just for a moment. In any case, Jed slipped from the hawk's grasp and plummeted through the air to earth. Or almost to earth. At the last possible moment, a porcupine walked beneath him, followed by a curious dog. Jed bounced off the dog, who was headed for some serious trouble, and landed in a pile of autumn leaves. Do we feel sorry for the hawk who has just lost his supper? Yes, a little. This is what is called a hard truth. But we feel sorrier for whoever became his supper. That is a harder truth. As for Jed, he had landed in something soft, but not before bumping his noggin on the dog. He lay unconscious within the fragrant pile of drying leaves. P.S. We also feel sorry for the dog, because porcupine needles hurt like no other thing. But that is a different story.
Your novel has so many playful qualities, as listeners could tell from that chapter. For example, your three principal characters move about a mile down the road and are amazed to find that squirrels in that area speak with an entirely different accent.
Right.
And you provide examples of that accent.
Yeah, I envisioned it as kind of a cross between Cockney and Pittsburgh.
That's very interesting. I wouldn't have come up with that, but...
Well, I'm a Pittsburgh native.
Yeah, I know that. So. I didn't know how we got to the Cockney, though.
Movies, too many movies. The accent in the book is called the reddish accent. It's the accent that the reddish squirrels have.
Yes.
And it was fun. I mean, once I heard it, it was so easy to write. And but a funny part of it is that a lot of the words are exactly the same pronunciation as they would be. They're just spelled differently. So so it looks like a different accent, and kids can sound it out and feel like they figured something out. And it will make sense to them.
So this is an unintended road trip, but most road trips are unintended. Mm-hmm. They move from the original hood a bit down the road, and then because of a great danger, they have to return to their neighborhood.
Right.
And they have to motivate their friends and their family to escape this coming danger.
Right.
And you show that squirrels are not easily motivated.
That's true. I didn't want to get too heavy, but I have to admit I was thinking of climate change. And, you know, how do you convince people to do the right thing, whether they believe you or not?
And you come up with this great scheme.
Right. And if only we could come up with a game like that in real life.
Yeah. So tell our listeners, it is a game.
Oh, well.
A game of sorts.
A game of sorts. The squirrels decide that since it's hard to convince squirrels of that there is danger coming, why should they believe it? They haven't seen any evidence of it. All they really have to do is get them to move out of the way, and squirrels really like games. So if they convince them that this is a game, that will work. And they only have to convince them for a short while. So they invent a game called Move, and they have to
move.
They have to move all their nuts to the neighboring grove.
And it's very successful.
It does. It gets them out of danger.
Now, your career has been so interesting, and you started to talk about that in the beginning. You were an art major in college. Mm-hmm. This was, at least in the beginning, never your intention to put together books.
Right.
How did this all evolve?
Oh, well, I did from time to time. I was a fine arts major. I majored in printmaking, and which is as useful when seeking an occupation as majoring in dressage, somebody pointed out to me.
Yeah, a whole lot of Fortune 500 companies send out representatives looking for...
printmakers.
Yes.
Not a lot. So anyway, I always thought that illustration might be a practical application of what I knew how to do, which was draw. But in fine arts department, those sort of things are looked down on, and I never had gotten much training in that area. I had taken one graphic design class, and then after graduate school, I took an illustration class. And I bounced around doing different things. I framed pictures, I waitressed, I worked as a graphic designer, and then I still always thought that illustration was something I could do. And a friend arranged for me to have a portfolio review with the art director of Green Willow Books, which is who still publishes my work. Mm-hmm. And the art director was very encouraging, and she told me my work was, I'll never forget it, because I carried this phrase around with me for months. She said, your work is eminently publishable.
Ah.
And then she said, do you also write? And I found out later that she asks everyone this question, but I thought she had seen something in me that no one else had. And I said, I have some ideas. And she gave me her business card and said, send us your ideas. Well, this was like, you know, Willy Wonka's golden ticket for me. So I went home and I wrote a story and I sent it to them and they bought it.
Wow.
So
it's a great story.
Yeah. I mean, it didn't happen until I was, you know, in my mid-late 30s, but it happened in a really nice way.
And it's continued on wonderfully for you.
Yeah.
Your launch was very unique this time. You invited lots of friends to come to Horizon Books and each one read a chapter.
Right. We had 25 readers. We had several librarians who are, including Jill Burt, the story lady, of course. Mm-hmm. And we had a number of people from Old Town Playhouse who were wonderful readers. And we had Ron Jolly mm-hmm. come and read a chapter. And then just a lot of people who like to read aloud. And it was really interesting. It was a great thing. If anybody's a writer, I recommend having other people read your work and listening to it. It, you know, it points things out one way or the other. But it was really fun. And that started because I have some friends who live in Milwaukee, and every Christmas Eve, Patrick, who was an actor for a while, reads the entire Christmas Carol aloud in one sitting.
What a wonderful thing.
I know. And I've never been able to be there, and I've always wanted to. So I thought, oh, maybe we could do that with my book. And I meant to read it aloud myself to see how long it would take, but I never got around to it. So I don't actually recommend doing it all in one sitting. I think a couple chapters a night is a good way to go.
The book again is Nuts to You by Lynn Ray Perkins. Your website is?
LynnRayPerkins.com.
And there's a whole lot of information there, photographs mm-hmm. and everything else. Lynn Ray, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Fleta Brown is here. Welcome, Fleta. Happy fall.
Hi, Aaron. Happy fall to you. There's not much left of it. The poet I'd like to talk about today is someone who's best known for his short stories, Ray Carver. If you've read his story, Cathedral, about the blind man, that's probably his best known story. You might think of him as a poet in prose, but he also wrote 6 books of poems, all of which are collected in the book called All of Us. You can easily think Carver's poems are prose, set out like poems on the page. They're just talking. But as you listen carefully, you hear the voice of a poet. As the Washington Post Book World says, his eyes are so clear it almost breaks your heart. The poems lean beyond what's on the page. Here's one shorter poem called The Window. You'll hear in it the word rhyme, which isn't the rhyme of poetry, but the ice crystals that form on tree branches. The window. A storm blew in last night and knocked out the electricity. When I looked through the window, the trees were translucent, bent, and covered with rhyme. A vast calm lay over the countryside. I knew better. But at that moment, I felt I'd never in my life made any false promises, nor committed so much as one indecent act. My thoughts were virtuous. Later on that morning, of course, electricity was restored. The sun moved from behind the clouds, melting the hoarfrost, and things stood as they had before. What I like about this poem is that the speaker enters it so delicately. It's really about him, isn't it? That for a moment in the dark, he feels okay, virtuous even. Then as the sun comes up, things are back to being as they were before. I admire that move in the poem. There's a lovely section in the middle of this collection called Some Prose on Poetry, where Carver talks about how he became acquainted with the world of poetry. I just have to give you this little story because it's so great. He was a delivery boy in Eastern Washington. He waited in the living room while the recipient of one of his deliveries was looking for his checkbook. There was a large library. He had never even seen a personal library before. and a little magazine on the table. Its title was Poetry. A whole magazine for poetry. He turned through the pages, and there was an anthology of poems near that. When he was leaving, the old man said, "Take that book with you, Sonny. You might find something in there you'll like. Take the magazine, too. Maybe you'll write something yourself someday. If you do, you'll need to know where to send it." Carver was 18 or 19, and he had tried to write a little. But right there in his hand was proof that there were, and I'm quoting now, responsible people somewhere out in the great world who produced Sweet Jesus, a monthly magazine of poetry. I was staggered. I felt in the presence of revelation. Is that a great story?
Yes, great story.
The Philadelphia Inquirer said that Carver's best poems play like short stories in miniature, small, heart-rending scenes that resonate with telling detail. Another reviewer said, "I don't think he had an abstract mind at all. He wasn't built that way, which is why he's so good at picking the right details that will stand for many things." Here's a longer poem with that's a good example of that, "The Lyrical Ordinariness." Yeah, I want to put those two words together, lyrical ordinariness, of the language coupled with a perspective you wouldn't have expected. It's long on the page, but it has short lines. It's called Limits. "All that day we banged at geese from the blind at the top of the bluff, busted one flock after the other until our gun barrels grew hot to the touch. Geese filled the cold gray air. But we still didn't kill our limits, the wind driving our shot every which way. Late afternoon, and we had four, too shy of our limits. Thirst drove us off the bluff and down a dirt road alongside the river. To an evil-looking farm surrounded by dead fields of barley, where almost evening, a man with patches of skin gone from his hands let us dip water from a bucket on his porch. Then asked if we wanted to see something, a Canada goose he kept alive in a barrel beside the barn. The barrel covered over with screen wire, rigged inside like a little cell. He'd broken the bird's wing with a long shot and stuffed it in the barrel. He had a brainstorm. He'd used that goose as a live decoy. In time, it turned out to be the damnedest thing he'd ever seen. It would bring other geese right down on your head, so close you could almost touch them before you killed them. This man, he never wanted for geese. And for this, his goose was given all the corn and barley it could eat, a barrel to live in and in." I took a good long look, and unmoving, the goose looked back, only its eyes telling me it was alive. Then we left, my friend and I, still willing to kill anything that moved, anything that rose over our sights. I don't recall if we got anything else that day. I doubt it. It was almost dark anyhow. No matter now. But for years and years afterwards, living on a staple of bitterness, I didn't forget that goose. I set it apart from all the others, living and dead. Came to understand one can get used to anything and become a stranger to nothing. Saw that betrayal is just another word for loss, for hunger. That poem gives me the shivers.
Yes, wow.
The implications of what's done to the goose extend way beyond the goose to what we can do to each other. Ray Carver died at 50 of cancer. I want to read you this poem, which I think is one of his best. It's so graceful. The tragedy and humor never overwhelm each other. There's no punctuation, no separation between sentences. It's called What the Doctor Said. He said it didn't look good. He said it looks bad, in fact, real bad. He said I counted 32 of them on one lung before I quit counting them. I said I'm glad I wouldn't want to know about any more being there than that. He said, "Are you a religious man? Do you kneel down in forest groves and let yourself ask for help when you come to a waterfall, mist blowing against your face and arms? Do you stop and ask for understanding at those moments?" I said, "Not yet, but I intend to start today." He said, "I'm real sorry," he said. "I wish I had some other kind of news to give you." I said, "Amen." And he said something else I didn't catch, and not knowing what else to do and not wanting him to have to repeat it and me to have to fully digest it, I just looked at him for a minute and he looked back. It was then I jumped up and shook hands with this man who'd just given me something no one on earth had ever given me. I may have even thanked him, habit being so strong. I find that poem so fully realized in its poignancy. I just don't know how it could be any better. So I'd like to end with this one last very small poem, which happens to be the inscription on his tombstone. It's called Late Fragment. "And did you get what you wanted from this life? Even so, I did. And what did you want? To call myself beloved, to feel myself beloved on the earth." The poet is Ray Carver. The book is All of Us, the Collected Poems from Vintage Books.
Thank you, Felita. Thank you for listening to Michigan Writers on the Air. I'm grateful to Benjamin Bush, Lynn Ray Perkins, and Felita Brown. Also, kudos to Brock Mormon and Peter Payette for their skillful engineering and production work on this show. This program is a production of Interlaken Public Radio. Be sure to listen next month to Michigan Writers on the Air on IPR News Radio. Until then, I wish you great writing, great reading, and the best of all words.